This episode is brought to you by Bombas. Summer's here and we're all chasing something. Maybe it's a break, a goal, a vibe. Well, let's not let bad socks and blisters ruin it. I know in my household, we are not letting that happen because my wife and I love Bombas socks. In fact, it's pretty much all we wear right now because they are such a step up in quality from your usual socks. They are comfortable, they are soft, they are functional, they're not going to fall down during the day, so you have to keep pulling them up. And guess what? They look good too, so maybe you want to look stylish for a wedding. It's wedding season. Well, Bombas has great stuff that's going to make you the best dressed guest. And if you're a runner like Paul, well, Bombas running socks, they wick sweat, they help keep you cool and fight blisters, but they also make specialized pairs for tennis, golf, hiking, you name it. And of course, we all love Bombas Mission, where one pair purchased equals one donated to someone who needs it. Head over to bombas.com and use the code CURB for 20% off your first purchase. That's BOMBAS.com, code CURB at checkout. Bombas.com and use the code CURB.
Is for entertainment, education, and information purposes only, and the topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any diseases or conditions. Furthermore, the views and statements expressed on this podcast are solely those of those and should not be interpreted to reflect official policy or position of any entity, aside from possibly Cash Like More Hospital and affiliate outreach programs, if indeed there are any. In fact, there are none. Pretty much, we aren't responsible if you screw up. You should always do your own homework and let us know when we're ready.
Welcome back to the Curbsiders.
Well, hi, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Life? I'm doing well,
Stuart. My cat's trying to escape.
Paul, you there too?
Still
we might as well jump right into the... Yeah, so of course, those are my co-hosts, Dr. Stuart Brigham and Dr. Paul Williams. I'm Dr. Matt.
And this is an internal medicine podcast.
That's right. What do we do on this podcast?
I do wonder sometimes.
Paul, what do we do on this podcast?
So we use expert interviews to bring clinical pearls and practice-changing knowledge to you, the listener.
Thank you, Paul. And on this episode, we have quite a bit of practice-changing knowledge, I have to imagine. We're joined by correspondent Dr. Leah Witt, and our guest is Dr. Eric Wadera. On this episode, we are talking about the American Geriatric Society Choosing Wisely campaign, which is 10 things that they put out, most recently updated in 2015, basically things that are not high-value care and that people should, in general, stop doing. And we talk about a bunch of those on this episode, mainly related to treating dementia, treating behavior problems in dementia, and a little bit about feeding in patients with dementia towards the end of life, particularly tube feeding. I think it'll be really helpful for your practice. As I was saying, our guest, Dr. Eric Wadera, is a clinician educator in the Division of Geriatrics at the University of California, San Francisco. He is the director of the Hospice and Palliative Care Services at San Francisco VA Medical Center and program director for the Geriatrics Fellowship at UCSF. You can check out an article. If you Google search his name, one of the first articles that pops up, it says, Top 10 Reasons Eric Wadera is the Best Fellowship Director Ever. It's a pretty entertaining read. It's a quick read, but it'll give you a sense of why he's so well-liked. In addition to what you'll hear on this show, he is also the co-founder of GeriPal, which is a geriatrics and palliative care blog and podcast, as well as ePrognosis, an online set of prognostic calculators for the elderly. So without further ado, here is our interview with Dr. Eric Wadera.
Matt, I'm so sorry. I completely forgot what we're doing. That's right. I'm supposed to come up with a pun. I had a really good one.
I highly doubt that.
I forgot it.
Okay. Well, Paul, I guess we got lucky tonight.
You dodged a bullet.
Okay. Here with us tonight are two wonderful guests. The first one I'll introduce is our correspondent. First time on air here is Dr. Leah Witt. Hi, Leah.
Hi.
We've been planning this episode and some other ones you're going to be on for a long time, so it's good to finally have you on the show.
Yeah, I'm really excited to bring this episode to you.
And a great guest. You gave us the inside scoop on a great guest here. So Dr. Eric Wadera of UCSF, he is a geriatrician, also known for GeriPal. Hi, Dr. Wadera.
Hi. I think this is like a radio show. Long time listener, first time guest.
Okay. I like it. And we've agreed ahead of time. We're going to call you Eric for, I guess, to keep it informal, like usual. And so this is the part of the show where we kind of just get to know, actually, we're going to get to know both of you a little bit here. So let's do ladies first. Leah, can you give the audience a one-liner about yourself?
Sure, I'd love to. So I'm a 32-year-old geriatrics fellow here at UCSF, a former pulmonary medicine fellow and internal medicine resident at the University of Chicago. I'm really interested in aging, chronic lung disease, and I did a postdoc research project on frailty and geriatric syndromes in patients admitted and readmitted with COPD. And I'm a native Wisconsinite. The Packers were terrible this year, unfortunately. Podcast addict and yoga body pump aficionado.
Paul, do you think we should make her explain the body pump thing now, or
no?
I would just yoga while body pumping.
No, you do yoga to recover from body pump.
Okay, we're why don't you? I think the audience needs to know at least a little bit about body pump before they won't be able to concentrate on the rest of the show if you don't just get it out now.
I think that's fair. I think it's a good wellness activity for any physician to incorporate into their routine. But the biggest barrier is to find a gym that subscribes to Les Mills in her amazing group of classes, including body flow and body combat. But I think body pump's the best. You do weightlifting choreographed to music. What's better than that?
So many things. No, but I'm glad that it's working for you.
Well, Eric, if you can follow that, could you give the audience a one-liner about yourself?
Oh, I can't follow that. I'm just going to keep a short one-liner from me. A 42-year-old blogger, podcaster who occasionally dabbles in geriatrics and palliative care, father of a 9-year-old, and I'm going to end with that.
Okay. Eric, I have to maybe embarrass you a little bit. I was telling Leah about this yesterday. I've mentioned on the show that I have an interest in geriatrics. I went full on. I applied to geriatrics fellowships. I was supposed to start this academic year at a geriatrics fellowship, and at the last minute, I decided that the curbsider was going to be my own kind of like general internal medicine social media fellowship, and I did not do the geriatrics fellowship. But there was a time after, I think I heard you lecture on Audio Digest. And then I was like, I told my wife, I'm like, you know, I want to do this geriatrics fellowship. I think we should go to UCSF.
And I agree. I think you should come here next year. We're going to hold a spot for you.
Yeah. I was so.
And you can continue curbside and podcast. I got all the equipment here for you.
Perfect. And she promptly shot me down. She's like, oh, yeah, let's move to a city that we can't afford with our 4 children with no family support. And that sounds like a great idea for me. So. Now I'm in Pennsylvania and I'm working as an attending, but geriatrics and palliative care are huge interests of mine. So that's why we're so happy to be doing this show.
Well, I always love your podcast. I've pretty much listened to every one, and the geriatric content on it is spot on.
So good.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, hopefully we will bring some more great geriatric content tonight. But first, Paul, I'm sure you have questions.
Oh, sure. Sorry, that was nice. Yes, so many questions. Let me just think hard about the questions I have. So I guess in terms of an icebreaker, I'll ask for each of you, actually, is there a book that you feel like every physician should read? And it doesn't even necessarily have to be a book about medicine as such.
So the book that I read over the holidays was Extreme Measures by Jessica Zitter. We were really lucky because she is in our area and she just gave grand rounds. And she's a palliative care and critical care physician, which is close to my heart given my previous fellowship. And she touches on some of what we'll talk about a little bit later in the podcast, but our emotional connection to food and how families and doctors really struggle with when their loved one can no longer eat. And what does that mean for caring for them and loving them? So I really recommend that book.
Is that Extreme Measures? Was there a Harrison Ford movie with that same title? I don't know.
that sounds right.
Probably, maybe it's unrelated. I don't know.
No, I'm sure it was a film based on the novel.
Maybe.
There is. It's called Extremis.
There is.
So Jessica Zitter, she actually went to the Academy Awards We actually had her on our podcast. So we had to ask her, unfortunately, I asked her, who or what did you wear? And the answer is who did you, or the question is who did you wear when somebody goes to the Academy Awards?
Obviously.
So I failed my interviewing duties.
Yeah, it's a short documentary.
Yeah, but Eric, I would be proud that you didn't know how to properly ask that question, actually. All right. But Eric, a book recommendation from you. What do you have for us?
We just did a book club on Daniel Pink's Drive, and it is absolutely a great book, great for any physician, and more importantly, if you're a parent. And if you're like me, I'm a big, you know, carrot and stick parent, like you do this or this is going to happen. And weird, it doesn't work. So this kind of made me rethink about how we increase internal motivation, which is about improving autonomy, purpose, and mastery over things. And it's great if you're a medical teacher. It's great if you're a parent. And it just, most of the stuff you kind of already know, but it just solidifies it. And I've done different things. Like I no longer connect like my 9-year-old's weekly allowance to him doing chores. Mm.
This sounds hauntingly like the tenets of adult learning theory, actually. This
yes.
is internal motivation and yeah.
I'm always looking for ways to subtly, you know, manipulate my children. So I think I should read this book.
It's great. And it's great for demotivating because, you know, if you just use the carrot and stick in reverse for things you don't want them to do, like pay them to do something you don't want to do and stop paying them 2 weeks ago, 2 weeks later, they're just never going to do it again.
Oh, this is brilliant.
It's great.
This is getting bumped way up on my reading list now. So thank you. Next question I wanted to ask is, Eric, any favorite medical app? It could be related to geriatrics or palliative care if you have one for the audience.
I was ready for this, listen to a lot of podcasts, and I don't use a lot of medical apps. The one I do is Twitter. I love the Twitter app, or just using Twitter to actually find really interesting articles, podcasts, people to actually follow and listen to. So mine would just be, getting on Twitter and following, like for me, hashtag HPM for hashtag hospice and palliative medicine or hashtag geriatrics. Those would be the ones that I love the most.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great way to keep up with the literature.
Yeah. That community seems to be, cause I've followed you on Twitter and some of the other people in the hashtag HPM circle, and they seem to be pretty active on Twitter.
Yeah, nephrology, very active. Palliative medicine, very active. We're trying to get geriatrics more active. So there's some great little communities on it.
Yes. Paul, any other questions here? Or Leah, did you want to ask Eric any questions that, you know, you haven't had a chance to ask him?
Oh, wow. This is really exciting. I feel so powerful. Well, I'm always asking Eric for advice. I'll ask him what advice he's gotten that's been really useful, either probably as a learner. What kind of advice would you give me, a fellow?
Yeah. The one advice that I got most frequently from the people I admire the most is, like, I would talk about their careers and they would say, oh, don't do what I did. And they always have this really curvy path to where they got to. So like, that don't do what I do, like do exactly what they did. Like, do things like podcasts, do things that are fun, that are interesting, that take you in new directions. If it's not fun, if you don't like it, just stop it. I've talked to a lot of people about like social media and getting on blogs or getting on podcasts, and they come up with these huge plans that take like 6 months to start. Like, just try it. And if you don't like it, stop it. But don't be afraid to fail. Don't be afraid to try something new, and don't be afraid to take that curvy path, because those are the ones, at least for me, are the most fun.
Right. Right. All right. Leah, did you want to give a pick of the week, or was the body pump fitness your pick of the week?
That's a pick of the year, but my pick of the week would be, I just saw iTanya. I highly recommend it. As a child of the 90s, it really reshaped how I think about the Tonya Harding and Nancy Kerrigan story as more of a class warfare kind of story. So I highly recommend it.
Hmm. I don't know. I still think I have like PTSD from that whole thing when I was a kid. I was so disturbed by it for some reason, or maybe not for some reason. It was probably a good reason.
Yeah, it was pretty straightforward why it was disturbing.
Ever She's since I heard that story, I thought ice skates were really, really sharp.
She's not necessarily a sympathetic character. I think they do a pretty good job of showing many of her flaws, but you might think about it a little bit differently.
Eric, did you want to give a pick of the week?
Dark on Netflix. So it's a German Netflix series. So they have a subtitle one, and they have one that's kind of like an old Japanese Godzilla movie where they talk over it. But really great series, makes lots of nods to one of my favorite movies ever, Donnie Darko. If you're a Donnie Darko fan, you're going to like Dark.
Ooh, that's a good one. Donnie Darko is a good movie too.
Yeah, yeah. Underrated. A lot of people haven't seen it, but yeah. Tons of nods to Donnie Darko on Dark.
I'm a big fan of Donnie Darko. I think the soundtrack to the movie and just a lot of the visuals are why I like it the most.
And yeah. You'll notice in this Netflix series, a lot of the soundtrack also on this, okay. Especially when like the high school scenes.
I remember watching Donnie Darko when I was a freshman in college.
Yeah, that's probably about right for me too. Paul, did you have a pick of the week?
I've also seen Donnie Darko.
Never seen it.
Oh, yeah, the Tears for Fears montage is fantastic. It's the only thing I remember about it. And by the way, let me just point out, these picks of the week are spectacular, by the way. I am duly impressed by our guests. Thank you. I'm going to recommend, actually, another Netflix series. I don't know if you guys have seen Wormwood, the Errol Morris documentary.
No.
This may not ring any bells, but Errol Morris is a famous documentarian. He did The Thin Blue Line. I want to say it was back in the late 80s, and it was groundbreaking at the time. And this documentary also does these sort of scrupulous, almost kind of impressionistic reenactments, and actually has like legit actors like Peter Skarsgård and Jimmy Simpson also. But basically, it's about this former CIA agent who basically was covertly dosed by LSD by the CIA as part of Project MK Ultra and fell from a hotel window to his death. And the whole thing's an examination of whether this was a murder, it was a suicide, and basically this guy's son's sort of pursuit of the truth and how his son's pursuit has kind of sort of colored his worldview. It's a fascinating, fascinating documentary that has better cinematography than most documentaries have any right to have. The reenactments are spectacular. The whole thing's really great. So it's, again, if you have about 6 hours to burn, I would recommend Wormwood.
I probably won't watch that if it's 6 hours, but that does sound like a good story. Stuart, if you have a real quick one, because it's probably about time we move on to... Okay, so
I'm going to save this one for next week.
Okay, so let's move into the topic at hand here. We're going to go over the Choosing Wisely campaign from the American Geriatric Society. But Leah, did you want to start us out with a case?
Yes, I'd love to. So we have Mrs. Sarah Quill here at our Cashlack clinic today. So Mrs. Quill, she's an 82-year-old female with hypertension, coronary artery disease. She's had TIAs, and she's got newly diagnosed mild dementia. She's here with her son, Mr. Haldahl. So he brought her in to discuss his concerns about progressive dementia. She was just seen for a memory evaluation in the Cashlack Neurology Clinic and diagnosed with likely Alzheimer's disease and vascular dementia. She lives alone, but her son checks on her every day and brings her food. She was previously a gourmet chef, but she's been burning food, leaving the stove on, and forgetting to take her medications. She's supposed to take atorvastatin, lisinopril, and clopidogrel. At the neurology visit 3 months ago, she was started on donepezil 5 milligrams daily. So I'll start by asking Dr. Wadera, how would you approach this patient? What questions would you ask?
Yeah, so it is always shocking when even this person who goes to a neurology clinic, not making the assumption that either the patient or the family member or the caregiver actually knows the diagnosis that we're talking about here. Even when it's posed or disclosed to individuals, sometimes euphemisms are made to try to, you know, soften the blow. Sometimes we just use a lot of medical jargon around this. And especially when I hear like likely or possible Alzheimer's disease, like what do patients and family members actually take home from that? So the very first thing I'd want to hear is like, this is a delivery of serious news visit. That's my main goal, is what did they talk about during that last visit? What's their understanding of the diagnosis that was made? Inviting them to actually talk about kind of what I'm thinking is going on, and then delivering that knowledge. So the framework that I always think about, I'm not sure if you guys have heard of spikes before, kind of an old framework for delivering bad news.
No.
So spikes is just a mnemonic. So S, just thinking about the setting that you're in, making sure everybody who needs to be there is there. And especially when we're thinking about dementia, like family members and caregivers, they need to be involved early on because they're the ones who are going to do the heavy lifting here in addition to the patient. So that's S. P is perception. Always start off, instead of us telling them what's going on, let's hear from them. It's kind of like a needs assessment. We're trying to figure out how much do they know? What areas do we need to help them with? I is invitation. Ask them if it's okay if we talk about kind of what we think is going on. If they're not ready to hear it, they're not ready to hear it. Don't push it. If they are, now they have some control over this conversation. Knowledge, just delivering knowledge. And when we're talking about dementia or Alzheimer's disease, making sure that we are using that word, we're not using any euphemisms. And that just like when we're delivering something like somebody has cancer, is expect that the next thing that they're going to be doing is going to be having an emotional response to that. So that's the E, is address emotions. So we're going to address emotions. We're not going to go straight into a cognitive describing what dementia is, but like, wow, like they just got this life-altering diagnosis. How are they dealing with this? And the last is the summarize and plan for next steps. That's the last S. So that's kind of where I would be with this person, is just figure out what do they understand about what's going on here. And then we move from there and to start thinking about, you know, next steps as far as what's their understanding as far as how this disease progresses. What's their understanding of, for instance, like therapies? She was started on Aricept 5 milligrams. What's their understanding of the effectiveness of these therapies?
And this may seem like a silly question, but whoever wrote this case, this is, I mean, I've kind of crossed this a million times.
And lots I feel of like Haldols and...
Yeah. No, specifically those names, we should probably change them for HIPAA purposes. But I mean, you tend to, at least it's this exact same scenario. Someone's brought in by their family member or caregiver because they're concerned. And basically, I know my inclination, I think almost because it's easier, is to actually turn towards the caregiver and have a conversation with them. Because I feel like There's often a lot of denial on the part of the patient, and a lot of resistance to the diagnosis. I wonder how you bring the patient and do the less cowardly thing than what I do, where I just sort of almost ignore the patient in the room and focus on the caregiver, because it's just so much easier to do. How do you draw the patient into this conversation as well?
Yeah, I think the key is that there is an emotional reaction to this diagnosis, just like there's an emotional reaction to any serious diagnosis that we give people. Is to spend some time acknowledging that. Acknowledge the anger that people feel around this diagnosis. Acknowledge the grief, the sadness, the loss, whatever you think that's going on with this individual. So, for example, if they're getting really angry that this neurologist diagnosed them with this disease, take a couple minutes and just explore that anger. Just naming that anger actually gives them a little bit of control over it. If they can name it, it's even better. So if they say, of course I'm angry, that's what we want. Now they have some control over it. Now we can actually talk about other subjects that they may not have wanted to if we didn't address emotions first. Mm-hmm.
I think it can be helpful in the room to talk to the patient with the caregiver next to the patient and try to include them kind of in a tripod conversation. But it can also be helpful to have some one-on-one time with the caregiver to get a little bit deeper into that conversation. So perhaps the patient can meet with a social worker or another member of your care team while you're going through that conversation.
That's a good idea. I like that. Be like, yeah, my nurse is going to recheck your blood pressure, and I'm going to stay here and have a conversation with this. The informant or whatever they call. There's terminology.
Probably not use that term.
Okay.
The rats.
Yes. All right. So of course, Mr. Dahl is going to want to know about medications to help out his mom here, and. One of the geriatric choosing wisely. So I'll read it verbatim. Number 6 here. Don't prescribe cholinesterase inhibitors for dementia without periodic assessment for perceived cognitive benefits and adverse gastrointestinal side effects. Eric, can you kind of let us know what this is getting at?
Yeah, so, you know, I would say like 5 or 10 years ago, there was a healthy debate about do cholinesterase inhibitors actually help. Strangely enough, when a lot of, let's say, Aricept went off patent, it seems to be less of a lively debate. These medications, when they do work, they don't work a whole lot. And when they don't work, they don't work and they can cause some side effects. So there are some people who are very polarized on this debate, some people who never use it, some people who try it on everyone. I'm kind of a middle grounder, is that when we talk with patients about their effectiveness, talking about how none of the medications we have can actually change the course of this disease, change the underlying reason people are losing their memory and some of their other functions, delay the progression of the disease, delay death. Nothing that we have can do this. These are symptomatic medications that may help a little bit with cognition, with function, maybe a tiny bit with behaviors, but that's it. And if people are not noticing a big difference, then also thinking about, is it worth continuing these medications because they can? They're extra pills, some of them are costly, and they have side effects like weight loss, like nausea, GI distress, for some people, vivid dreams. So again, thinking, do they really need to be on this?
Mm-hmm. And the side effects are really common. There's a study on adherence and tolerability from 2017 in JAGS, and I think 81% of participants reported adverse events across all the cholinesterase inhibitors. Donepezil is probably the best tolerated, but they also had a lot of discontinuation because of cost. So these, they can be expensive and hard to tolerate.
And since you brought it up there, the head-to-head, the cholinesterase inhibitors, is there any one that we should use? Is it just whatever's on formulary for our patients?
So there's not a lot of difference between them as far as really evidence-based that they're any more effective or have less side effects. There's one study that shows adherence may be a little bit better with Aricept, mainly because it's cheaper, because it's generic.
Okay. I wanted to point out one of the side effects. Eric, I heard you give a lecture on this on another program, which I won't mention. It was Audio Digest. And you were talking about pacemakers being placed but for patients having bradycardia. I'm not sure if that's something that's happened commonly, but I was appalled when I heard that.
Oh my God, you actually did listen to that. It's shocking. I think a really good point is that these medications are associated with bradycardia. And we've actually seen it here where people got a pacemaker instead of actually just turning off the Aricept or the cholinesterase inhibitors.
Oh yeah.
That's horrifying.
Yeah. And unfortunately, the one person that I could think of actually had a complication with the placement of the pacemaker. Yeah, this is not a trivial thing. So. Right. Always keep in your back of the mind when that individual is coming to the ED or on your medicine service or wherever you are and they're bradycardic, take a look at that med list. Don't just look for beta blockers, but look for these medications, especially in those dementia patients.
And I was looking this up beforehand because we had on Dr. Dukoski, Stephen Dukoski. He's from University of Florida. He's a big researcher in dementia, Alzheimer's disease. And he said that he doesn't really believe the whole falling off a cliff when you just suddenly stop these agents exists. And I was looking, there was a randomized trial. It was like donepezil or memantine, and whether they stayed on it or they just abruptly stopped it after having been on it for at least 3 months. And it looked like the difference in the mini mental status exam was like 1.5 points or something like that. And the difference in the battles BADLS score was out of 60 was about 3, something like that. And they considered a clinically significant difference on the mini-mental out of 30 to be 1.4 or 1.5, and on the battles to be 3 or above. So like a 5% change on a 30 or 60-point scale. To me, that doesn't sound, you know, by those scales, it's not that impressive. And then...
No. And it's not. It's definitely not a cliff. If anything, it's like a tiny little bunny hill.
So in that, the difference between the people who abruptly stopped donepezil or memantine was like on the mini mental, it was something like 1.5 points if they abruptly stopped it. So I don't know. I mean, it could be like the nocebo. Paul, is that nocebo or placebo? If you stop it and then you think the person gets worse, I don't know.
I don't know what that is.
Yeah. Okay. Anyway, yeah,
I would say that when you think about the effectiveness of these agents when the studies, if you believe the studies, there is a statistically significant improvement in function, cognition, and behaviors. That is generally like a 3-point improvement on a 70-point scale. And the debate isn't, is this statistically significant? The debate is this clinically significant?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And what we're seeing is there's argument on what is clinically significant. Does that meet that measure? But that should give us some reassurance that when we're stopping these medicines, first, it didn't really help that much, so it's not going to really hurt that much if we stop it.
Right.
I haven't seen these people going off cliffs. Maybe they go off like a tiny little bump on these very in-depth scales when we test them. But I don't see those big decreases.
Right. Okay. I think we've put that to rest. Leah, where did you want to take this next? Did you have on this topic here?
Yes. Oh, I can move on with the case.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the other thing that we should also think about, like there are other formulations out there. I want to go back to your question, like which one's the best to use? Choose the one that's cheaper. And even with Aricept, these drug companies are really good at trying to increase profits. So there's also like Aricept 23. Have you heard of that before?
No.
It's great. So you take a generic drug, which could have then been Aricept 20, and any pharmacist can just give, you know, 2 pills of 10, a generic drug for pennies. But you add an additional 3 milligrams, all of a sudden you have the potential for another blockbuster. So 23, nobody can do like a substitute.
Yeah.
So you have this Aricept 23, and I'm sure no scientists are saying, oh, these extra 3 milligrams, they're really what we need on top of 20.
that's what was missing.
That's what was missing. And what we see is... It really doesn't help that much, and it's associated with a boatload more of side effects. Oh. So when we're thinking about like Aricept 23, just don't use it. And if you're thinking like somebody's no longer swallowing, should we use like the patches, which could be more expensive? Also think, does this person still need to be on this drug? If they're not swallowing anymore from their dementia, odds are these medications are not actually going to help anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, I think as we're critically thinking about these medications, it's really important to look at funding sources for a lot of these studies, because a lot of the studies are pharma sponsored, and some of the clinically significant, the outcomes that focus on clinically significant outcomes, such as time to entering into an institution, there really hasn't been good data that any of the cholinesterase inhibitors slow the time to nursing home living.
Yeah.
And memantine, another one that's frequently used, like none of these cholinesterase inhibitors, memantine, they just don't work for mild cognitive impairment. So like that pre-dementia phase. Memantine really has only shown benefit for people with moderate to severe dementia. And I think the other is when people say severe dementia, they don't mean like hospice severe. They mean like a mini mental of 5 or 10. Like mm-hmm. These people are still talking, still chatting away with you. They have more severe disease, but they're not those people who are no longer swallowing. They're not those people who are bedbound.
Right.
Those people were not enrolled in these studies.
In your practice, now that you're mentioning, if we think someone is end stage and they're not talking much, they're more bedbound, are you just pulling these medications?
Yeah, I'm doing a huge medication debridement. Like okay. I'm going in there with medication debridement scalpel, just knocking these off. Because what we're worried about there is weight loss. and other symptoms like GI distress. And like these medicines cause that. So I am removing anything that could be associated with that, because I'm much more worried at that point about weight loss than a, you know, 3-point improvement on a 70-point scale.
Okay. Now, the Choosing Wisely recommends that you check in at least by 12 weeks to make sure we're assessing for all these things we've just been talking about, and then deciding if you want to keep these medications. Is that what you do in your practice, more or less?
Yeah. In my practice, I think of these medications as a red herring. Just don't focus. This is not what caregivers need. This is not what patients need.
Yeah.
I think it's important to reassess whether or not they work in, you know, 1 or 2 months. I think thinking about if we're going to use it, let's titrate it out to an effective dose of, you know, 10 milligrams. And if there's side effects, stop it. But don't get in the trap that the only thing that we can do as clinicians is treat this pharmacologically.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't work very well. And when you talk to patients, when you talk to family members, when you talk to caregivers, and what you see in this case is, I'm going to diagnose you with a really bad disease, and then 3 months is the next time they see a physician or a clinician. And can you imagine if that was cancer? I'm going to diagnose you with metastatic lung cancer.
Yep.
Oh, and I'll see you in 3 months.
Okay.
That wouldn't happen.
This is where you involve your interdisciplinary team. And if you identify needs where your social worker can be helpful, I think the social worker can really provide a lot of high contact and emotional support, and you kind of do an evaluation of if there's any home services, adult day programs, PACE programs that they qualify for, and be supportive to the caregiver and the patient.
What is a PACE program? Is that?
So a PACE program is a program of all-inclusive care for the elderly. That, unfortunately, at this point, Mrs. Quill doesn't qualify. She needs to be nursing home eligible. And typically those patients live at home and they're picked up a few times a week and brought to a day center where they get medical care, medications, activities, and things like that. But it can be an option to keep people who would otherwise live in a nursing home in their home if they have a good home environment.
Yeah. Paul, do we have that in Philadelphia? That sounds great.
No, we have home health aides that we can sign folks up for that don't actually, it's not worth getting into.
Okay. All right. Let's move on, because I want to kind of keep an eye on the time, which I'm terrible at doing, but why don't we start talking about some of the behaviors that I heard Miss Quill became quite unruly a little bit down the line. Can you tell us about that, Leah?
Sure. So a year later, Mrs. Quill is now living in a memory care residential facility. She's been falling quite a bit, and she's having difficulties with bathing and dressing herself. So there's an aide that helps her. And she's frequently having verbal and physical outbursts when she's frustrated or scared, especially at night. The nursing assistants have been asking her doctor, that's you, if you can prescribe something to help calm her down. He asks, Mr. Dahl is there with his mom, and he asks about Tylenol PM and clonazepam, which he's taken before when he's anxious. What do you think, Eric?
I'm probably not going to say, yeah, let's go for it.
Sounds great.
Yeah. I think this puts, I mean, this is one of the most frustrating thing as, you know, clinicians, again, whether it be MDs, NPs, social workers, is that we're not at these residential facilities. We often are not talking to them. They're facing this. Caregivers are facing this. And I think everybody is looking for an easy solution. And unfortunately, there is no easy solution. I always think about it as like my 9-year-old. I get frustrated. I get angry. I get scared. There is no drug that's going to fix that for me. So why do we think this person with dementia, there is going to be a drug that's going to fix that for them? And why would we want to medically treat that feeling scared with some type of medication without actually first actually figuring out what's going on? Now, if they're like severe hallucinations that are distressing, I think that is a reasonable place to think about like antipsychotics to help with the hallucinations. Outside of that, the case that always comes back to my mind, Cashback. I was briefly an intern at Cashback. I had a patient who became agitated, was trying to punch and hit the nurses, and I was asked to actually start some type of medication, an antipsychotic, to help with that. Decided to actually just walk over there and see him. He was blind. The nurses were trying to put in a Foley catheter. Oh, nobody told him what was going on. So his bad behavior is just a normal reaction to the situation. So I think just understanding these people are living in their realities. They're trying to experience the world and communicate what they're feeling. It may not be in a way that we think are like good behaviors, but they're communicating something. Our job is to figure out how to communicate with them and figure out what may be causing these things that we're labeling as bad behaviors.
So Eric's talking about the DICE approach, which talks about how we can address some of these really stressful behaviors, stressful for patients and caregivers. So the D is describe, the caregiver describes the problematic behavior, and you're thinking about the context, the social and physical environment, sensory impairment, like Eric's patient who's blind, or many of our patients who have hearing impairments, and it's nighttime, their hearing aids aren't in. I is investigate, the provider investigates possible causes of problem behavior, pain. We talked about medical conditions, psychiatric comorbidities, poor sleep, or loss of control. C is create. So providers, caregivers, and the team collaborate to implement a treatment plan. And this includes all members of the team so they feel heard. I think a big problem is that the on-the-ground workers, the nursing assistants, can feel maybe like we're not hearing the really distressing behaviors that they're dealing with. So I think it helps to have a team meeting where you show them that you hear the behaviors and that you have a plan so that they can follow some steps that are outlined when the behaviors come up. And then E is evaluate. The provider evaluates whether the interventions have been successful or safe.
Yeah, that I actually, we have had a couple tricky patients in the hospital at Cashlack. And my team was telling, like, the patient kept getting put in restraints overnight. And when my team, we got the charge nurse, and the nurse told us the behaviors that she was having. We talked with the charge nurse. We figured out a plan, moved the patient closer into a different room near a window, and had a one-to-one, and we were able to keep the patient out of restraints. And, you know, so it is that sort of thing where it just took, like, it had been going on for a couple of days, and I'm finally like, we got to get to the bottom of this. Let's just go talk to the whole team and figure this out. And it worked. So the DICE approach, I didn't know what it was at the time, but yeah.
What's really helpful is having somebody sit at the bedside. But, you know, the balance of that is that it's expensive. It's somebody's time. And I think that's often why restraints get placed and medications get ordered. Mm-hmm. So we're facing really difficult logistic challenges at hospitals and at nursing homes. How do you see the challenge about when people are asked to put on restraints for safety? And
yeah, I think it's critical, especially if you're trying to teach med students and interns, like, go see the patient, figure out what's actually going on. In addition to DICE, I use the ABC approach. So what was the behavior? Accurately describe the behaviors, the D and DICE. What was the consequence of the behavior? So for instance, like, if I get called that somebody's wandering and that's why I should use like antipsychotics, like, what's the consequences of walking? Like, sometimes it's nothing. Like, let them walk. Think about other ways we can actually like prevent that person actually leaving the hospital. But that's not a consequence I'm really that worried about. And what was the antecedent? So that's the A. What came right before the behavior? Was it they were trying to put in a Foley catheter? Was it they're trying to give this person, especially in a nursing home, like their daily showers? Like, do they really need daily showers? How else? And really trying to individualize this care. So if always happens at night and the patient's not going to sleep, like, learn a little bit more about the patient. Have they always worked a night shift? Like, you may face an uphill battle if you're trying to convince that patient to go to sleep at night when they've never gone to sleep their whole night. nothing is going to fix that problem, except we have to fix the environment and ourselves. Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I come from a nursing home background before I went to medical school, and I actually worked in facilities that had sort of secure dementia units. And I feel like the skilled nursing facilities are actually far more progressive than the hospitals that I've been in terms of the use of chemical restraints and physical restraints. That was a catastrophic failure in a nursing home. And now it feels, I won't say it's the first thing we reach for in acute care settings, but I see it used with far more aplomb than I would in a skilled nursing facility where you just don't do that. You adjust the environment, you meet the unmet need. Like that's how you prevent falls and prevent agitation.
Yeah, because they are heavily regulated on that, and we're not in the hospital. So right. Like, we see antipsychotics used for sleep agitation, but like, right. Let's do a little quetiapine 25 to help this person go to sleep. There's no evidence for that. So sometimes we jump a little bit too quickly to some of these medications.
Can I ask you why we're so worried about these medications?
Yeah, so
a little underhand pitch there.
We're just going to repeat exactly what we said for the anticholinergics is like the evidence of their effectiveness is actually relatively small. When we look at any medicines, so when we look at antipsychotics, evidence that when they do work, the evidence that how effective they are is actually kind of marginal, I would say. And they come at significant risk for cardiovascular events, increased risk for death. So there's a black box warning on them. A recent JAG study showing increased risk for aspirations. There may be confounding issues with that, but I kind of believe it. Like the goal for these agents is often sedating. So what happens when people are sedated? They don't protect their airway as much. So that's antipsychotics, not very effective. When we look at other agents, whether it be like antidepressants, so citalopram, another one that's been studied, been shown to be helpful at higher doses to help with these types of behaviors. And helpful is, again, these small increases in large scales helpful. It's probably safer than antipsychotics, as there's no black box warning for death. Death is a pretty bad outcome majority of the time. But unfortunately, even that, they used 30 milligrams in that study, and now we're maxed out at 20 milligrams because of QTC issues. A new drug that just came out, Nudexa. Have you heard of that before?
I have heard of it. I don't know the generic for it.
It's a mouthful. Dextromethorphan and quinidine.
Aricept 23, we're going to take two incredibly cheap drugs, we're going to combine them together and make a blockbuster. So like dextromethorphan, you can go to your pharmacy and get some DM, you can get some tonic, and you get your quinine, you got your Tussin and tonic, now you combine them together, you get this new dextromethorphan drug. What happens actually is the dextromethorphan, nobody really knows how it works, maybe some NMDA receptor issues. But, you know, like if anybody's worked in ED, like teens use this to actually get their, it's the dissociative hallucinogenic.
Sure, the Tussin.
Yeah, the Tussin. And then what the interesting, I'm going to go wonky a little bit. The interesting thing about the quinidine is it's a P450 inhibitor. So it actually increases your blood levels of dextromethorphan.
Oh, nice.
So you get a little bit more of teens, please, earmuffs, don't listen to this. You get a little bit more of that dissociative hallucinogenic property. Initially used in ALS for pseudobulbar affect. And then they tested in dementia because there's not enough ALS patients out there to make a lot of money. So dementia, big one. JAMA study showing small benefit. So there was much hype around that. They didn't really talk about falls that much in that study, but there was a significant increased risk for falls. They didn't mention the statistical significant, but there was, I think it was a doubling of falls. And it, like somebody like, not Hal Dahl, what's her name?
Mrs. Quill.
Oh yeah, Mrs. Quill. She's already falling. This is not a drug that we want to use in her until we actually get a little bit more evidence of its safety and efficacy.
Okay.
So no Tussin and tonic, just avoid it.
So the AGS choosing wisely, number two says no antipsychotics. Number four says no benzodiazepines or other sedative hypnotics in older people as a first choice for insomnia, agitation, or delirium. Is there ever a time to use benzos or sedative hypnotics?
Yeah, I mean, so Ativan, will it make, we talk a lot about like paradoxical reactions to Ativan. Honestly, most people who get Ativan, they're going to get sleepy. You give in a big enough dose, they're going to get knocked out. So it's going to make your life that night a whole lot easier. It's just going to make that next day that much harder. Because now, you know, if you've ever taken a benzo, that next day you're a little bit more foggy. If she's already scared, she's going to get more scared. Like, she is going to try to figure out what's going on with her. Why does she feel so fuzzy? Somebody giving me stuff in my food. She may stop eating. It's not a great place for people who are not, who will never come off it. And the one time that I do use it is near the very end of life. Mm-hmm. When my main goal is sedation. Sometimes people's behaviors, sometimes people's agitation gets so bad near the very end of life where we do actually use these medications. But the primary goal is not to actually fix the delirium. Mm-hmm. The primary goal is to treat the symptoms of delirium, mainly through sedation. And I would reserve that for people, not people with moderate dementia, not people with severe, people with end-stage dementia at the very end of life receiving hospice care.
What about melatonin for patients admitted for delirium? There was a small article from the International Journal of Geriatric Psychiatry from 2011 looked at that. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so there was a study also, I think, in JAGS too, Journal of the American Geriatric Society out of Japan, looking at melatonin to prevent delirium. There was issues with that study because they screened a whole bunch of patients and they actually whittled it down to a smaller group. They did show actually a decrease in delirium episodes. And I kind of understand, like, if you, the hospital is the worst place to try to get some sleep. Melatonin, relatively, the side effects are relatively small. I think I don't use it to prevent delirium. If people are having difficulty sleeping in the hospital, it is often my first go-to. Not because we have a whole lot of evidence. We don't have any evidence in the hospital for any sleeping agents, but it has the least side effect profile. And it's worth trying for people who can't sleep in the hospital. We use a lot of trazodone and other agents. There's no evidence for those either. So might as well pick the one that has the least side effect profile.
Are you using a 3 or a 5 milligram?
I use low dose. I use like the 3. I don't trust the 10s. Like, you go to Walmart right now, there's like a 10 milligrams of melatonin. And that's going to really screw up your sleep-wake cycle. So I use lower doses. There's probably that placebo effect too that's going on. People just want to feel like we're doing something. The better intervention is actually thinking about this as a system intervention. How can we actually make the hospital quieter at night?
Reduce labs. We all have 4 a.m. labs ordered. Think critically about if that's necessary and the timing.
So bringing in the lab techs, bringing in the nursing. And nighttime vitals, like all of these things, like this is the trying to create spaces where we actually are more conducive to sleep and which will help with delirium.
Yeah.
And I've seen mirtazapine used. I did want to bring this up. I feel like there's almost a magical thinking that because it does everything, right? So it's going to help with their sleep and it's going to improve their appetite. And then also the depression that comes along with it is going to fix that too. And I've seen it work 100% of the time, all the time. So I was wondering what your experience with mirtazapine was and if there was a role for it as well for both either sleep and then maybe we can move on to appetite after this and see if sort of helps with that aspect as well.
Yeah, it's that little magical drug. So my main thoughts are it's a good antidepressant, good as any other antidepressant. It has a side effect profile that is worthwhile to think about when we're choosing which antidepressant to put someone on. But if they're not depressed, there is no evidence that it's going to help with their appetite. There's no evidence that it's going to help with their sleep. With that said, like, you start somebody on low-dose mirtazapine, like 7.5, 15, and what I hear from our geropsychiatrists is the sleepiness actually does better at the lower doses. Once you get into the 30, 45, they may not get that same benefit. So it may help them with their sleepiness. What it does as far as to your sleep, to your REM behaviors and all that, I have no idea. So I would just be cautious. It's not it's not a great drug for people to be on if they're not depressed. And I would be very cautious to use it just for insomnia. Same thing with appetite. Unfortunately, it's generally something else is going on that's affecting their appetite. And trying one of these agents that really have never been shown to actually help outside of the setting of depression, we're often dangling false hope to the patients and their caregivers.
Is that our segue to the eating portion of this podcast?
I think so, yeah.
My favorite topic. So Mrs. Quill comes back in three years, and she's now completely incontinent. She's dependent on with all of her ADLs. She's having difficulty speaking, and Heldahl is having a hard time understanding her. She's moved to a long-term care nursing home, and her son is really worried about her appetite. A nursing assistant hand feeds her, but it takes an hour and she really eats less than 25% of her meals. She's coughing a lot after she eats, and she was hospitalized twice in the last year for pneumonia. Her son asks how we can improve her appetite and if she should get a feeding tube. Eric, should she get a feeding tube?
Great question. I think this is one of those things why it's incredibly important. Instead of falling for that red herring trap, just focusing on drug therapies early on in the course of dementia, is actually preparing patients and their family members for this to happen very early on. So we're not just talking about this at the very end, that we're talking about the progression of the disease, which will inevitably include eating problems, swallowing problems, weight loss. This is what we see near the very end of life. And it's not just like the very end of life. This is like the last year, year and a half with dementia. And actually including the patient in the discussion about kind of what they kind of would want. I would not focus so much on the PEG tubes, because what we know about PEGs with advanced dementia is that they don't improve nutrition, they don't improve weight, they don't improve things like pressure ulcers, they don't improve survival, they don't improve any nutritional parameters like albumin, they don't actually prevent aspiration. So they don't do anything that we wish they did.
Then why do we even offer them?
That is a great question. I've actually gone up and down. Initially, I said, why are we even offering these things? Like, we shouldn't even talk about it with our patients in the hospital because they're not effective. But then you realize we live in a fragmented healthcare system. And if we don't bring it up and talk to family members and patients about it, or at this point with advanced disease, family members, somebody else is. So I think it's actually important to bring it up as something that we don't do, and how we wished that it would help. But what we would recommend are other options to help with their weight loss, to help with their swallowing problems, to help with feeding them.
This is a really emotionally charged topic for families. The book I mentioned at the top of the podcast, Extreme Measures, Dr. Zitter has a passage about food. And we see this in the ICU. We see this in our outpatient clinics with our patients who have dementia. And she talks about how families see food as a major form of support, both physical and spiritual. And she talks about how the artificial calories from a feeding tube feel like versus a medical treatment, they kind of feel like love. They are showing their family that they love them and care for them and want to nourish them. So it's really charged.
Would your position or the way that you approach this change at all if, say, you had an advanced Parkinson's dementia where they require the sentiment for their swallowing, for their bradykinesia, and we don't have a good IV alternative, so the only way to administer it would be, say, through a PEG tube. Is that something that would change that discussion?
It may. So when we talk about lack of evidence for PEG tubes, we're talking about observational studies, not randomized control studies, observational studies around Alzheimer's disease. I'm never going to say that PEGs never work. If you look at ALS patients, there's pretty good evidence that it actually may help improve the quality of life of patients with ALS if they want that type of intervention, potentially survival. for people with Parkinson's, we don't have a whole lot of evidence for PEG tubes, what they do as far as survival. I would say that cinnamon actually does a very bad job of helping with those muscles that help with swallowing.
Okay.
So it's not going to help people's swallowing problems. And when they get to the level where they're having significant swallowing problems and they're thinking about, you know, how to deliver these medications, things have not gone the way we'd hope with their disease. They're progressing to their end stage. And I think it's important for family members to know is that these types of interventions like PEG tubes may not prolong survival. They likely will not prevent aspiration. I think what's helpful when we're talking to family members is just like feel the inside of your mouth right now, how moist it is, how much saliva is in there. They're producing a whole lot more saliva than honestly most individuals with dementia are taking in as far as fluid. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole lot worse for you than like that can of Ensure. Like there is a whole lot more bad bacteria in there. And that's, we're not going to fix that with a PEG tube. This, and going back, this is a disease that their brain is slowly deteriorating. Their brain has now failed to the point where they can no longer even manage to swallow.
Eric, I wanted to ask you, so she's been hospitalized a couple of times at Cashlack and had some speech and swallow evaluations, and they recommended that she was NPO.
Yeah. Man, the amount of times I've seen this at Cashlack. So it's hard. It's really hard for providers. Somebody comes in with pneumonia from a nursing home. Speech sees them the next morning to clear them to eat. They don't clear them. They say that they need to be NPO because they're aspirating on their bedside swallow exam. And now we're stuck. Now the decision is, oh, do we keep them NPO? Do we put in a PEG tube? And that's a false decision. The decision isn't that. The decision is, should we carefully hand feed this individual, even in the hospital, because they're going to be at risk for aspiration, even if we put in a PEG tube? Or are there other reasons why we should think of a PEG tube for this individual? And honestly, a vast majority of times, it's not. Mm-hmm. So that should make us think, okay, now's the time for a goals of care discussion with the family, because their brain has deteriorated to the point that they can no longer swallow. And this is something that we did here in the hospital. We actually met with our speech therapists because this was happening. And they felt like they had to say NPO because that's what us doctors wanted. and what they just wanted to tell us was just, can you just talk to the family members that we should accept this risk? And we felt like, oh my God, we can't not make them NPO because speech actually told us. So actually talking with your speech therapists, and I just did this today with another patient, is making sure we're clear on the question. The question isn't, should this patient be NPO or not? The question is, what is the safest like diet for this individual,
right,
given these swallowing problems and given the overall goals of care?
Yeah, I think there's also a third option in there, that if they're admitted and they're delirious, maybe we shouldn't be doing a speech or a swallow study in acute delirium. Maybe we should treat first and then repeat, or?
I think that's a brilliant thing. I think it's okay if they see them early on. You know, getting people nutrition early on is probably important with delirium, although not a lot of evidence. But definitely repeating it frequently, like having that speech therapist should be a close member of your team at that point.
I wanted to just bring up, because Lee and I had talked about Dr. Thomas Finucane. I don't know if I'm pronouncing his name right, but
probably not. If history's any indication.
Yeah. He's a geriatrician from Johns Hopkins, and he gives a lecture on misinformation in nutrition. Have you ever heard it? It's fantastic.
No.
He talks about a couple things that I think are really interesting. So Dr. Finucane talks about patients. He talks about a med student who was like lost in the woods for like 6 weeks, and they checked his albumin and it was stone cold normal. And he says that when you anorexic patients will often have normal albumin. But if you get these patients with advanced cancer, multimorbidity, there's inflammation, these patients, no matter how much you feed them, generally do not, the body is not ready to accept the nutrition. So he's talking about those are patients like supplements and feeding tubes he doesn't recommend. And then he also talks about this thing called girth creep, which is a term that I just love. And he talks about looking at pictures of the Last Supper and how the apostles and Jesus get progressively heavier and heavier as we've gone through time, and that the perception of what is a normal weight is now so warped. He says in 1885, the average West Point graduate weighed 135 pounds. And now if you see a man weighing 135 pounds, you think they're underweight and something's wrong with them. So he was just talking, you know, just this, all this psychology and all this like sort of history, people are thinking, and probably they're thinking incorrectly about nutrition and malnutrition, what the definition is in some of these patients. Like you're saying, these patients, their brain is already deteriorated. So does feeding them matter when this is kind of the natural end of the life cycle? And then for, this is an adjacent topic, patients with like advanced cancer, multimorbidity that have inflammatory states, they probably can't heal. So it's a brilliant talk, and I'll send it. I'll send you guys the link to it. But I'm a huge fan of him.
Yeah, I mean, I think the asterisk always with these PEG tubes, because sometimes when we talk with like med students, they generalize PEG tubes for everyone. Like even in cancer, like head and neck cancer patients, they actually do a lot better with PEG tubes because there is an isolated swallowing issue. Mm-hmm. Is that this cancer is blocking it? Mm-hmm. It's not that you have this huge pro-inflammatory state where they're just not metabolizing it. Same thing when we're talking about like dementia, is like in Parkinson's disease, it's harder because what sometimes happens is they develop these swallowing problems earlier on in the course of dementia. Mm-hmm. And then like, I have to be honest, I have to be clear with the family members and the patients that I have uncertainty. I don't know whether, are they more like the head and neck cancer patient or the ALS patient, or are they more like the advanced dementia patient? And that I'm using also my clinical gestalt, how bad their dementia is.
Yeah.
Outside of feeding tubes, the other two things that we often feel compelled to do are order nutritional supplements and thicken liquids.
Ah, two of my favorite subjects. So actually, I keep on getting boxes of Ensure sent to me by someone. Like I'm looking at a box of a case of Ensure, and I have no idea what to do with it. So I actually put it outside thinking, nobody's going to drink this. And they keep on disappearing. So somebody in our office really likes Ensure.
I hear it's good in a white Russian. You should try it.
with some quinidine.
Really, really no evidence that they actually help with individuals with advanced dementia. When we're looking at nutritional supplements for people who are severely malnourished, there may be some small evidence. It's probably better than like multivitamins, which has no evidence for anything.
Darn it.
but really, I would, again, I think that's a red herring conversation. I think we should really focus on what's going on here when we're talking to family members about nutritional supplements, because it's usually not that they're not taking enough in. It's that they're not wanting any more food. That they're having swallowing problems, that they're coughing when they're actually trying to take in things like food or fluid, and really having the discussion about what to expect with advanced dementia. As far as thickened liquids, we did this. We actually sat down with our hospice team. We were going to do a taste test. of different diet consistencies, because I thought, oh my god, like these pureed diets look absolutely disgusting. So we're gonna try these different diet consistencies, and we tried it. Turns out I love pureed diet. Like, oh my god, it's delicious. However, on that pureed diet was this can of like thickened liquids. So we actually tried it, and everybody agreed that it was horrendous. So we decided, can we actually only drink thickened liquids for 12 hours? Because 1 in 12 nursing home patients are on thickened liquids. Like, it is incredibly common that we use these medications. So if they're doing it, we can definitely do it for 12 hours, right? So we tried it for 12 hours. Nobody was actually able to tolerate thickened liquids for 12 hours. These are health. Like, I'm 42 years old in my one-liner. My urine was never as dark. I had a splitting headache. I was incredibly dehydrated. And again, I'm a healthy 42-year-old.
And your albumin dropped.
Albumin plummeted. why do we think somebody who is 82 years old with advanced dementia can actually tolerate this? And so we have to think, okay, but there must be some evidence that it actually works. When we looked into it, there was really none. Wow. There's really no evidence that it prevents important outcomes like aspiration pneumonia. There's actually one randomized controlled trial, which really made me excited, but it really didn't show any patient-centered outcomes of importance that these commonly used treatments for dysphagia actually have any meaningful benefit in people with dementia and Parkinson's disease. And it came at a risk of dehydration, UTIs. So really pause. And we started something called, we call the hashtag thickened liquid challenge, is people trying to record themselves taking these thickened liquids for 12 hours and seeing what it looks like. And the really cool thing is the intern who was on our service at that time actually did the thickened liquid challenge. She did a video of it. And then she wrote a JAMA IM article on the lack of evidence for thickened liquids for people with dementia.
I want our listeners to send videos to thecurbsiders@gmail.com of yourselves doing the thickened liquid challenge, and we'll make a super cut of it, and we'll put it out there on our YouTube channel.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Hashtag thickened liquid challenge.
Yeah.
And if you want some inspiration, you can actually look at it. It's on YouTube. Hashtag thickened liquid challenge. And the cool thing is, people from across the U.S. did this. Like, we had speech therapists did this to help promote, like, dysphagia understanding. We had people from Australia try this. It was really great to see. And part of what I love social media is that it really breaks these geographic boundaries.
Yeah, absolutely. Leah, do we have anything else? Are we kind of coming down to the end here?
I think we're coming down to the end.
So maybe... I'll throw it out there. Stuart, do we have anything on social media that we need to address? And while he's looking, Paul, did you have any last minute questions?
Yeah, this is supplement adjacent. I don't think we talked about, often the question I get is about appetite stimulants. And I know the medical students and the residents love dronabinol. Well, maybe not for themselves, but they always suggest it. And Meg AC here suggested megestrol acetate thrown out there. Is there any utility in any of the appetite? I know the answer, I think, but any utility in the appetite stimulants for patients who are maybe not quite ready for the PEG conversation, but mom and dad just don't seem to be eating as much as they used to?
Yeah, so great question. Yeah, unfortunately, for a wide variety of diseases, there's really no evidence for appetite stimulants as far as meaningful patient outcomes. Not just a subtle weight increase, but like helping with some of their sarcopenia, which is oftentimes the things that we worry about. Because sure, some of these medications may help a little bit with improving amount of fat, but medications like Migase actually come with a cost and a risk, you know, whether it be DVT, it's a progesterone. So we tend to avoid Migase. Dronabinol, I wish people liked taking dronabinol as much as smoking marijuana. But honestly, when we talk to patients, they don't get a lot of benefit from dronabinol. Studies are also on whether or not it actually helps. And when you talk to people who've had benefits before getting the munchies on marijuana, it's actually using all of marijuana. Dronabinol is just one component, the THC component, and there's hundreds of components to marijuana. Not that I'm advocating for marijuana. I also work at a federal facility, so Cashlack v. Federal Cashlack. But I would also say that for some patients, they may get benefit from that, but it's probably also that placebo. They feel like they're doing something that they often feel passionate about, and that may make them have more of an appetite. Other than that, I don't really recommend any of the other appetite stimulants for the majority of diseases, not just advanced dementia.
I like how Choosing Wisely spelled it out with Megace or Megestrol. They said doesn't improve quality of life or survival. There's fluid retention, thrombotic events. The number needed to treat for weight gain, but no like meaningful clinical benefit. The number is 12 for the number needed to treat. The number needed to harm is 23 patients. will cause one death. So if you treat 23 patients with megestrol, you can cause one death with it.
That's horrible.
And you might
get
two patients would gain weight but have no improvement in quality of life or survival. So those numbers, I wish I had like numbers like that for every treatment that didn't work, and I could just like off the cuff say it to patients. I love that. It's just right in the, so you got to look up the AGS Choosing Wisely, which we'll link. It has a lot of fun facts like that that you can share with your patients.
Tons of fun. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Going back to social media, I don't see a lot of questions that weren't already addressed. There was a couple of questions that probably would be answered by the osteoporosis lecture and about imaging in dementia. But I think that was discussed before on our previous episode, was it not? I think it was.
Yeah, so we can refer then to those. So why don't we ask Eric, did you have any favorite take-home points from this episode that you wanted to give to the audience?
Yeah, okay. Starting from the beginning, when you have that patient, even if there's something documented in the MR that they have a diagnosis, always assume nobody told them or they did not remember their diagnosis. So take time to deliver that serious news, explore their emotional reaction to it, and then talk to them about the progression of the disease, what to expect. Don't fall. That's my first one. The second one is don't fall for the red herring of just focusing on pharmacological therapies for dementia, because at best they're marginally effective, and at worst they cause side effects. We can still do a lot as clinicians, as physicians, as far as communicating what to expect with the disease, being a supportive sounding board to patients and their caregivers, helping with behaviors. The third point is for behaviors, non-pharmacological, clearly before any pharmacological therapy, and use the pharmacological therapies for as short a time as possible, any of them. So even if you use some of the newer ones like Tussin and Tonic or Nudexa, use it for the shortest amount of time as possible. None of these have any long-term efficacy trial data. And then the very last thing around feeding, so the fourth point is, if you're getting that patient where there's an NPO recommendation from speech, or you're thinking about appetite stimulants, or you're thinking about a PEG tube, whether or not it should be done, or you're just thinking it shouldn't be done, like that is a time you should pause and think, okay, we need to have a discussion with our family members. We need to have a goals of care discussion. Even if I don't bring up PEG tube, it is a reason that I need to have this discussion with a family member about where we're heading from here. Because all paths are not paths that most people are hoping for, and they're leading to worsening functional decline and death.
Yeah.
Do you have a more positive take-home point you'd like to end with after that?
I think the positive is, I think it's really important. I think we can get so worked up about the lack of things that we can't do. Like I remember as a med student, sorry, any neurologists who are listening, like you used to make fun of the neurologists because all they had was aspirin.
True. It's true.
However, there is so much that we could do as clinicians, not just referring to like Alzheimer's Association, which is incredibly important that we do and making sure that they follow up with that referral. But family members are eager for our help and advice. They don't want to just see us 6 months after we diagnose them with this illness. They need help earlier on. We can educate them about this disease. We can be, again, a support for them. We can, if they're having behaviors, going through the DICE framework, there's so much that we can do. So don't feel like there's, throwing your hands up in the air. Like, I mean, sometimes I do feel like doing that. But remembering that you are incredibly well-trained for this. There could obviously be more training, but there's a lot that you can do.
Beautifully said.
That will allow me to segue to, I was going to plug for you the Jerry Powell podcast, which I've been listening to. Do you guys do it weekly? It seems it's several shows a month. It seems like, I'm not sure if you're at a weekly, but
yeah, we try to do a weekly. I love it because you get to talk to great people. We actually had Jessica Zitter on the podcast, and it's great just to learn from a bunch of folks. We try to do weekly, but again, it's a hobby. So
yeah,
we do our best.
Yes. So that's the Jerry Powell podcast. They talk about a lot of topics that will supplement tonight's show, and I highly recommend that you check it out. And Eric's partner, Alex, on the show, he sings songs at the beginning, which I think we're going to ask Stuart to start doing that, if you don't mind.
I think you'll just lose Paul completely if that's the case. He'll just send you his resignation letter.
Okay. Well, Eric, you have a burrito waiting for you from what I'm told, so we need to let you go.
burrito and tonic.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
And I'm sure
some Marinol.
Yeah. And Leah has to go beat somebody up at her body pump class. So we're going to let you both go.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on. I want to be very honest. I absolutely love your show. I actually had to take the boards, the geriatric medicine boards. And I use your show to study because there's so much great geriatric content on it.
Thank you. Well, we're going to have to do some more crossover episodes, Jerry Powell and the Curbsiders, and do some more geriatric topics.
Oh, yeah. It could be like a weird sitcom.
Yeah.
That's right. Jerry Side.
The Jerry Siders? Yeah, that's something like that. Yeah. I like it.
Oh, that's good. I love that. Trademarked.
Or the Curb Pal.
This has been another episode of the Curbsiders, bringing you...
Jerry Powell.
This has been an episode of the Jerry Siders.
That's right.
Bringing you a little knowledge food for your brain hole.
Quite delicious.
You can find show notes along with links to any articles, books, websites, or apps mentioned on the show at thecurbsiders.com/podcast. Sign up for our weekly mailing list to get a PDF copy of our show notes at thecurbsiders.com/knowledgefood. And please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes. This will help other people discover the show, which helps us get more audience and get better guests and make more shows. So please do that. And you can send an email to thecurbsiders@gmail.com. You can tell us what you love or hate about the show, recommend a future topic. You know the drill. Until next time, oh no, wait, I need to plug our social. You can follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and on Twitter at The Curbsiders. Until next time, I've been Dr. Matthew Frank Watto.
And I'm Dr. Stuart Kent Brigham. Hey, Paul, you know, the longer I know you, the more disparaged you look on camera.
That probably has to do with how long I've known you for, I would imagine. And I remain Paul Nelson Williams. Good night.
Good night, Paul.
Is cash lack just purely because the joke around lacking cash, or did you have another reason you used cash lack?
It's my grandmother's, it's my paternal grandmother's maiden name is cash lack.
Wow. I had no idea. Deep cut.
I don't think
I've
ever mentioned that on one of your podcasts.
Yeah.
At least
I don't know if I have. It comes up a lot in pre-recording.
A little peek behind the curtain.